Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game with me, Gab Markovty. This week, is Torres back? Have Tottenham burned out? Is there anything Di Canio can do to save Sunderland? And will Everton make the top four? And in our debate this week, we're going to go somewhat beyond the sceptered aisle and include the Bundesliga, where they all speak English anyway. Now, to help me with all these points, I have Rory K. Smith, Julien Laurens, you know him as the handsome man from Le Parisien, and of course, from beautiful downtown Ripondon, in fact, his conservatory, I believe, it's Ollie K. But let's start in North London, White Hart Lane. Ollie, I'm going to start with you with that horrible, horrible, horrible stat. Spurs haven't won a game since January 1st, unless Gareth Bale has scored, and it's difficult even for somebody as talented as Bale to score if he doesn't play.
Yeah, well, they missed him. They missed him certainly on Sunday. I think any team would miss their best player. I think that's fair to say. But I think Spurs without Bale are a completely different and completely weaker proposition. Funnily enough, they did start extremely well with a goal that came from the left hand side. But I thought that the all round threat that they have when Bale was there, it just wasn't there. And I felt in the end that they were slightly lucky to get that late equaliser. I mean, I thought watching it that Everton perhaps seemed more likely to score the fourth goal of the afternoon on the break. So I think Spurs will end up thinking that they perhaps got away with it there because they've kept Everton at arm's length and not lost too much ground on Arsenal and Chelsea.
Julien, is Ollie right, or is he proving once again his Northern Blue Nose bias?
Everton played a much better game, in my opinion, tactically, collectively as well. I think Spurs defensively were very, very poor yesterday. Again, it's not the first time against Basel. They conceded so many chances, and they were lucky to concede, only two goals, but it was two goals. It could have been three or four, I think, on Sunday against Everton, if Anichebe and Jelavic and Miralas had been a bit, more precise. And I think when you defend like that, you really have to question yourself, because there's not many games left, and they can't afford, I think, to keep on defending like that.
Right. I want to talk about the Spurs defense for a minute, because the line I was fed is, well, he's got five defenders. One of them, Yunus Kabul, is injured, and that's the guy he probably thinks is best out of all of them, and you play him all the time. The problem with the other ones is they've all got something slightly wrong with them. William Gallas is old. Stephen Caulker's too young, and Michael Dawson's too clunky, and Jan Vertonghen's not perhaps quite as athletic as people think he should be. Now, this is my opinion. This is the opinion that was given, and so he mixes and matches based on the opponent. Is that kind of like a fair excuse for Spurs to give, or is it kind of like maybe you should just pick two and stick with them?
No, I think it makes sense of Villas-Boas. He's got, as you said, I mean, I think you kind of have to discount Gallas, who I think we can now accept is beyond salvation.
But if he could go back in time, he's so much better than all those guys. But
yeah, no, a top class Gallas is better than all of those. Although I've got to say, I think Jan Vertonghen's been one of the best players in the Premier League this season. I think Vertonghen is absolutely superb. I'd always have him, and I personally think him and Kolker kind of have everything you need as a central defensive partnership.
Kolker on the ball.
Well, no, Vertonghen's... I think the problem with Kolker is that he's young, so he will make mistakes, and you can't really afford to do that in a race for fourth. Vertonghen's the ball player, Kolker's the athleticism. That's quite a nice balance, I think. But Villas-Boas does have this policy of against sort of big muscular strikers such as Victor Anichebe, he'll play Michael Dawson, who copes better with the physical side of things, and that makes sense. I suppose that a natural consequence of that is perhaps that the communication between the pairs isn't quite as good as it might be, but that's not an excuse necessarily for conceding goals.
So what is the excuse? Sandro being out?
Well, I think Sandro's a big loss, but I think, to be perfectly honest, and there's this kind of habit that we have of always looking to blame someone for everything, but I think the point is with yesterday was that, I mean, it takes a lot to beat Everton. Everton do not lose games unless the opponents play really well, and that's an enormous compliment to Everton. Everton are a good team. There's no desperate. It's not a terrible result to draw at home to them. In the context, it's not enough, but Everton they're extraordinarily difficult to beat.
Ollie, are we going about this all wrong? Should we just be celebrating Moisey once again rather than pointing out Spurs' flaws and say that, you know, Everton maybe deserved to win that game, as you said?
I still think it's open to debate, and I think we've debated it, and we've probably come to the conclusion that Everton did very well and played in a certain way and a game plan that worked really well. I would single out, if I could, Anichebe, not just for his performance yesterday, but the complete transformation in a guy who previously seemed to have kind of the raw materials, but not the work rate, not the attitude, and it's just. I thought, looking at him yesterday at times, and looking at times over the past few months against Manchester City, for example, he just looks like a fantastic player, and that is a tribute to Moyes. I know people turn around if Moyes leaves Everton in at the end of the season, or if he doesn't, people will say, well, you know, he's never won a trophy. But you look at the improvement in players like Anichebe and in Baines and the recruitment. I think Everton are a fantastic example, and I know there will be lots of wailing amongst Everton fans if they narrowly miss out on fourth, and if they think, well, if we'd had another 5 million, we'd have been able to get a top four place. And you know, I can understand some of the frustrations, but I think there is so much that's admirable about what Everton do and the way they do it, both on the pitch and off the pitch.
I'm going to ask you specifically about an Everton player who's been in this country for a long time, has played for several clubs. I don't actually know if he's ever played for France, but I think he rarely has a shocker, and I think he's aging gracefully, making himself more and more useful to the people around him, and that's Distan. What's your take on this? Is some of it down to Moyes? I mean, I'm assuming you're in touch with him. And I'm just thinking back to the fact that France very cleverly only took three central defenders to the Euro, one of them being Philippe Mixès.
Yeah, he's an unsung hero. It's funny, it's probably more known.
Does he have any French caps?
No.
He's got as many as you do.
Yeah, exactly.
How's he seen in France? What's the view of him
That's
in France?
That's the thing. He's probably better known here than in France.
Because he's just some guy who left
career.
Early and like...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, he went to the PSG Academy, then they released him because they thought he was not good enough at a young age. And then went to the small club in Guignol, and then won the League Cup against PSG, which was the irony, obviously, of his career. And then went to England. So he's probably better known here than in France. I just think he's a fantastic guy. For me, we know him a bit. And you know, he's had tough moment. If you think about the FA Cup last season, for example, where his back pass, it was last season, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For a player like him, it's hard to take because he loves Everton so much. He would give anything to win a trophy with them, for example. And that back pass hurt him so badly. It was just terrible to see him after the game and with the burden of that mistake on him and that defeat and everything. But I just think Moyes made it the player he is now more than anyone else, and I think him and Jagielka are probably the best pair of centre-halves in the league, in my opinion.
Ooh, I set that a marker. I gotta get Smith and Kay on this one. Rory, who do you take ahead of those two? I suppose you are allowed to say the virtual pairing of Vidic and Ferdinand, but
yeah, no, who plays regularly?
Yeah, maybe wouldn't. I mean, I think Jadielka and Distan complement each other perfectly. Maybe Kompany and Nastasic. That's a good pairing. Julian has it sailed in a Gallic way.
It would be maybe in a couple of years something. Nastasic is still a bit unproven, in my opinion.
Yeah, possibly. No, I agree. I mean, I think Distan's one of those. They're great stories, aren't they? The foreigners who come over really early, and they just become kind of institutions. Like I can't really remember a Premier League without Sylvain Distan. He's been playing since 1983, and he was to be fair, he was good for Portsmouth as well. He was a good player for Redknapp at Portsmouth, and
good for City.
Yeah, he was good for City.
He was one of those sort of big money buys when City didn't realise they couldn't afford it. He has been one of the better central defenders in the Premier League for the past decade.
The two fatal flaws of David Moyes' time at Everton have been his inability.
Fatal means deadly, by the way.
Well, a fatal flaw is a phrase.
Everton are alive and well.
But the fatal flaw is a phrase. It's
major
stop,
flaws. And let's talk about being so morbid, talking about death all the
stop
time.
Stop being a pedant, right?
We are talking about the Bundesliga later, so one, it seemed appropriate.
One is his inability to work out how to play in European away games. Moyes is really bad at that, and that, I think, is probably the thing that will stop him getting a major job if and when he decides to leave Everton, is that he doesn't seem to know how to play away from home in Europe. The second is his transfer record. But if you look at people like Distan, and particularly Kevin Marias, who's been magnificent since coming in, it's a shame he can't play 90 minutes, but Marias is incredibly direct. I saw them against Stoke last week when he scored that goal when he ran for 70 yards, and he scored an even better one against Spurs. It looks to me like Moyes, who's always been very kind of an Ollie will back me up on this, I would hope. Moyes is very uncertain in the transfer market because there's not much money. He sort of dallies around and thinking, oh, maybe I should sign him, maybe I shouldn't. If you speak to his scouts, he kind of goes up and down. If he wants to sign someone on a Monday, he'll have decided they're useless by Wednesday. He's very kind of nervy in the transfer market, but you look at some of the successes he's had recently, and he's getting a lot better. And that's summed up by Marias.
I want to throw in one of my favourite signings, which I think they got from some small team in Ireland, is Seamus Coleman.
Brilliant.
Who I think has been slowed down in many ways, but I just think he's a very modern player who might even benefit at a different club or with a different system. But
he's a win back, isn't he, Coleman? He's a 3-5-2 player.
I very rarely see him play badly. You know?
What's interesting about Miralas is obviously he went through the Lille Academy in France, played in France, where he had a problem with his attitude.
It's all to do with France.
Yeah, because, and that's my point, he had a problem with his attitude because the game in France has too much discipline in it, and he can't do discipline. That's why maybe he can't play 90 minutes. But also,
Cantona didn't do discipline very well in France either.
But in the Premier League, there's much less discipline. Obviously, you know, I can imagine Moyes saying to him, just do what you're good at, just run with the ball. Clearly, yesterday, Sunday at Spurs, he didn't really trail back or didn't really help. I mean, he started on the left-hand side, he didn't really help Baines at all whatsoever. You know, so he clearly is just there to do a bit what he wants, and he does it really well. And that's the big difference, and that's why he's so good. Because before the start of the season, when he signed at Everton, if you had said to a French, someone like a Lille fan, oh, Miralas signed for Everton, he would have said, he's useless. Yeah, he's going to score a few goals, but you know he can't play well over the whole season. And clearly, he showed that he's at that level now. And in my opinion, it's because of the difference between the two leagues.
Now, I think Finkelstein gave Everton a 5% chance of making the Champions League. He gave Liverpool a 2% chance for those keeping score at home. Whereas I think Spurs, he had at 58%. As you know, this is all very scientific, but I'd rather hear Julian's opinion. Either one of these two teams have a shot at top four?
No. Neither.
You think Spurs are done?
Oh, no, sorry. I thought you meant Liverpool and Everton. No, Spurs.
Comedian.
I'm really rubbish in prediction and stuff. I think Spurs and Arsenal will finish in the top four, and Chelsea will miss out. I know it's hard, but I think they will obviously qualify in the Europa League. I think it will cost them a lot of energy. I think they were really lucky on Sunday, and I don't think they really play well in the Premier League, to be fair.
You're talking about Chelsea?
Yeah.
All right, we'll be getting to them in a moment. So you reckon Spurs, yes. Everton, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everton, I would love to get in the Champions League, but no, they're too far off. I think Spurs will pip Arsenal. and qualify with Chelsea.
Oh, you're getting back at Julia. This is really funny. This is so cute. Ollie, once again, of course, you're the voice of wisdom and sanity. Please sort them out.
Right. I was tempted to just say whatever would be different, but I think...
Well, different then in that case, you'll say
Chelsea
Everton.
And Arsenal.
Yeah.
I think I think it depends how... No, you just want team names, don't you? I'll just say Chelsea and Arsenal and move on.
So no shot for Everton?
No, I don't think Everton will quite make it. No. I wouldn't say they have no chance, but I just... They've got more points to make up, and it's hard to do that at this stage of the season.
Right, let's move on now to Stamford Bridge, where Chelsea got a win, which leaves them nicely on track, I think, to finish top four. But of course, they got the win against Sunderland, who had a new manager. Julian, let's start with you, since you thought Rafa Benitez was lucky. Was that because Sunderland were good, or because Chelsea were bad?
So first of all, and I'm sure Rory K. Smith would back me up on that, Paolo Di Canio probably listened to the podcast. Please, never again that jumper. Never again that jumper. This, for a first game in the... No, it was impossible. And you're Italian as well, Paolo. You cannot wear clothes like that when you're Italian as well.
You didn't like the jumper?
Oh, no, man. That purple, I don't know, it's not squares.
Did you notice he wore the red tie to show off his communist leanings?
Yeah, but no, the jumper, Paolo, please, never again.
Although, of course, purple was the colour of the Roman Senate. Is that another nod towards...
Gav, say something.
Towards his disgusting political leanings, since denied.
Purple is also the colour of the bishops in the Catholic Church.
Could be, yeah.
You know, the Pope,
be.
And therefore God lives in Italy. So, you know, you can read this many, many different ways. He's also a fan of the band Deep Purple as well.
Yeah, okay. Head. And Prince's song Purple Rain.
No, he doesn't like Prince.
No, he doesn't like Prince. Good. That's another black mark against him.
Why?
Well, you can't not like Prince.
Really?
Yeah, it's Prince.
I don't think Prince.
Julien? Prince? Or as they call him in France, Prince?
Prince? No, not Prince.
Hey, Ollie, can you steer us back to football, please?
I was going to.
I was just about to take issue with Rory's like of Prince. He doesn't strike me as a classic Prince fan.
I'm not like a super fan, but it's Prince. He warrants respect.
He likes Spandau Ballet. That's
I do like Spandau Ballet, yeah.
Right, there you
and
go.
Depeche Mode.
Therefore, you're just like Di Canio, because those are two of his favourite bands.
What, Spandau Ballet and Depeche Mode?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. In fact, his big thing was he won an award like when he was a player, and they got the guy from Spandau Ballet to give him the award. And he was so happy, and he started dancing around the stage and things like that. He became like a little kid again. So there.
That's the effect that Tony Hadley has on all of us, isn't it?
Well, clearly, right. Rory is far too much in common with Paolo, so I'll go back to you, Julian.
So, yeah, I think it was a bit of both. I think Sunderland were really good, especially in the first half. I think physically they clearly faded in the second half, dropped much, much deeper, and then it made it difficult for themselves, to be fair. But I thought they really prevented, you know, Chelsea from playing. I thought they were well organised. I was a bit sceptical tactically, you know, about Di Canio before that first game, thinking, well, if he only works with the motivation of the players, it might not be good enough. But I thought he got them really well organised yesterday, and I was really disappointed by Chelsea because of the way Sunderland plays. And I think if Cessinho had been just a bit more clever in the first half, they would have gone 1-0 up much earlier, because if he had crossed the ball to Conor Wickham, I think that would have been a goal quite early on. And I think... I was really nicely surprised by the way Di Canio, you know, played this team yesterday.
Rory, Matt Hughes was somewhat less impressed in the Times today. What did you make of it? And also the decision to drop Danny Graham for Conor Wickham.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a big call. It's kind of cutting to Graham's self confidence. But then Conor Wickham is. He has all the attributes physically to play that sort of lone striker role very well, and it's always been a bit of a mystery. He was really good at Ipswich, and he was, you know, there was a time not so long ago when Conor Wickham was kind of the great white hope for English forwards, and it's strange that he's never really been given a chance.
Does somebody want to make a suggestion about why O'Neill didn't play him and felt the need to bring in another striker?
I wouldn't like to allege anything.
Ollie, do you want to speculate?
No, I don't. But I was going to question Rory on his use of the racist phrase "Great White Hope," but no, maybe we've been there already.
You can tell that Ollie's had the whole week off.
Yeah,
like, we're all like kind of just sick of talking about this, especially yeah. me. But Ollie's just going to continue making like you know little comments on this. No, but I'm a serious question about Connor Wickham because I saw somebody when he was at Ipswich with the under-21s as somebody who's got you know he's got size, he's got. He's got very good feet. He seems to have a decent understanding. Probably not the most physical player, even though he's a big guy. Mm-hmm. Doesn't strike me as an O'Neill type center forward, really at all. I mean, somebody was telling me, oh, but he could be a Chris Sutton type. Yeah, but you know, Chris Sutton played with Henrik Larsson and John Hartson, and with those guys, it's kind of like everybody kind of looked good with those people around him. And it looked to me like sort of Wickham had been kind of shelved a little bit.
Well, I think the thing with O'Neill is O'Neill was loyal to, and there's no point sort of raking over this old ground, but O'Neill had a core of 12, 13, 14 players who he played all of the time. And Wickham, he's obviously a manager, and there's plenty like this, who has favourites, and once you're not in, you're very much out. And Wickham
but
never got a look at
all.
To
the point that when it came time to buying somebody else, you know, when you can kind of ask yourself, what do I do if Fletcher gets injured? It's not, I'll turn to Wickham. It's, I will go and buy this other guy who's a Newcastle fan, you know, Danny Graham. So clearly he didn't see the future with...
No, he obviously wasn't sold. In terms of Sunderland, I think I have a theory on the relegation battle, which is that I don't know if Sunderland or Wigan will win again until May. I think the final spot is between them. I think QPR and Reading are gone now. After QPR's heartbreak yesterday at the hands
of 45 years of career for Harry
the
right
diminutive genius that is Sean Maloney, who's probably one of the most underrated players in England. But anyway, and I think what will kind of be decisive is whether Di Canio, they have to look at the debt, those two teams have to try and win three games, and there are three games that Di Canio can win, and there are three games that Wigan can win, and whichever one of them doesn't win those three games will be relegated.
Ollie, do you find it appropriate the way Rory's speaking about there's three games that Di Canio can win and three games Wigan can win? I mean, wasn't it all about O'Neill when he kept them up?
But
it's
not the managers, and I as a matter of principle, I don't disagree with Ollie, because he's my hero, but it's not the managers who make it about themselves. It's us. It's the media who make it about the manager. It is. There's no. It's you occasionally get managers who take, like Wenger does it really well. He takes the pressure onto himself rather than the players. Mancini's got this habit.
Well, Mourinho's the ultimate example.
Yeah, and Mancini's got this habit of saying, "Oh, actually, sorry lads, I prepared the game wrong. I forgot to train them this week." Every time they lose at Everton, which is bizarre, but generally it is the media who as Ollie says, create this narrative whereby it is Di Canio who will succeed and Di Canio who will fail, just as when O'Neill succeeded, it was O'Neill's triumph, not, you know, this is all to do with Craig Gardner.
Ultimately, Ollie, it's the same set of players who got them into this, and they're the guys who are going to get them out, right?
And it's pretty much the same set of players, you know, give or take a few that Bruce had. And I think what we can see with Sunderland over the past few years is that there is a bit of a sort of decay there. And when Bruce first came in, he made a good start, and then the malaise set in. When O'Neill came in, the same great start, malaise sets in, and it seems to me that there is a bit of a rot at Sunderland. I mean, it's not an inspiring place to go to, as it was, you know, when they were first in the Premier League at the new stadium. And I think there's a possibility that Di Canio could re-energise the club in the short term, but I don't know how good a manager he is to do that in the long term.
I want to get on to Fernando Torres, because we have to show him love after, you know, weekly crucifixions for much of the season. I'm sure it's not the match.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Ask, although there is sort of a theory that there's some kind of supercomputer in there that sends impulses to different parts of his cortex and gives him balance and awareness and so on. But I thought he played well in, against Rubin Kazan. And when he had that acceleration leading up to the first goal, I thought it was like traveling back through time, right?
I was at the Rubin game.
Did you like that?
And Torres, I've got to admit, Torres was absolutely fantastic for 75 minutes.
The first goal was ridiculous and lucky.
It was lucky to an extent, but the presence of mind to stick a leg out and slip it under the keeper was quite impressive. The key moment, I think, more than that goal, was about 5 minutes later when Fernando Torres did a Rabona, yeah, which you do not see Fernando Torres do very often these days.
You need to explain that. How many people in our audience know what a Rabona is?
All of them. Okay. A Rabona, for those who maybe are new to football, is where you are carrying the ball and you twist your back leg back around the standing leg and flick it with your laces, basically. It's a Rabona. Google it.
I'm well aware what it is. I'm just
can you describe it? I can't really, it's hard to describe it.
How do you say in Italian? What's the word?
Rabona.
Okay, it's coup de foulard in French for the
it's
French
what?
Speakers. Coup de foulard.
Ah, okay.
Ollie, listen, you're older and wiser than Rory. What is the English term for it? Can you educate our young Rory?
It's basically fancy Dan foreign nonsense.
Gotcha. There you go.
But that Rabona for me had enormous spiritual significance, because not only was it was evidence that Torres still believes in himself to do stuff like that, and it kind of gave him the confidence to go on. And for the rest of the game against Rubin, he looked like a really, really difficult striker. And that Rubin looked really bad.
Yeah.
Were you there?
Yeah,
you were there, weren't you? You were in a really bad mood.
I was going to say, I think Dembaba would have had a hat-trick as well against him.
But I don't know whether that was Chelsea making them look bad.
I don't know. I'm still sceptical.
I think Rubin...
Resurrection again.
Yeah, and I think you can't presume that this is kind of Torres's back, blah blah blah. But he did play better against Rubin than I have seen him play for probably 2 years.
All right. Well, you guys all gave me your opinion before about who will make the Champions League, so I don't need to ask you about that. But just to clear this up once and for all, Rory, because you read Rafa Benitez's book, does he get annoyed when people sort of suggest that this business with the cup competitions is better than is more important to him than the top four? Does he really not care? Does he? Because I've heard conflicting things about him. Because I've had somebody who knows him relatively well say that he's kind of like an obsessive who like gets up and like early and reads all the newspapers so he can know who's saying what about him. Is that the impression you got in reading his book?
I don't know if he reads the newspapers
or if there is
someone who reads the papers. But yeah, Rafa's media awareness is relatively high. It didn't used to be like that, and I suspect it's not a positive sign that it is. I think Rafa Benitez, I don't quite understand the intensity of the debate. This is fairly simple. Rafa thinks they will finish in the top four and can win the Europa League and FA Cup all at the same time.
Should be some kind of treble then.
But he's obsessed by winning trophies, yeah? He keeps saying, I've won those many trophies in those many years and this and that. So surely, you know, if you ask him to choose between, you know, like he says, he won't be there next season. So if you ask him to choose between a trophy and a top four finish, he would go for the trophy.
I don't. Well,
to add to his
list. I think that is a. I think first of all, I don't think he thinks he's choosing between them. I think he thinks he can do it. I think he thinks
if
he had to. I don't know, because I think he does want the trophies to bolster his CV, because he knows that will help him get a better job in the summer. He thinks it will. But I think he also knows, he's not stupid, he knows that if he doesn't finish in the top four with Chelsea, the teams who he wants to get a job with will think, well, your primary objective there was to get in the top four with Chelsea, and you failed. So I think he knows that they are kind of comparatively important.
Bayern Munich became champions of Germany this week. They set a whole raft of records along the way. They won it with 6 games to spare. Nobody else had ever won the Bundesliga title with more than 4 games to spare. They won 11 consecutive games, which is another record. They will, you know, barring some kind of act of God, set a new record for points, because I think they have 75. The previous record was 79. They will set a new record for victories. They have 24, and the previous record was 25. They're going to set a new record for goals conceded, because they've conceded 13, and the record was 24. And obviously, they will equal the record for fewest defeats in a season, since they've lost one, and presumably they won't lose any more the rest of the way, or they may not lose any more the rest of the way. So it's absolutely fantastic, and a lot of people are saying that, you know, they're their smart bet to lift the Champions League. They're on track for treble. They're in the semifinal of the German Cup as well. We could all sit here and celebrate Bayern Munich, but Ali, I want to start with you, because there is another side to this. We're all talking about the rise of the Bundesliga and what a great product it is and how fan-friendly it is and so on. Flip side is, I kind of wonder if Bayern just aren't too strong, and then they don't just have too much of a built-in advantage. Their revenue is more than twice that of the number two and number three teams, who are Borussia Dortmund and Schalke, combined. They basically do pretty much whatever they want in the transfer market. Not signing Marco Reus last year was the exception that kind of made the rule. And with financial fair play coming in, they're going to get just even stronger. 20 consecutive seasons making a profit. We all talk about how great the Bundesliga model is, and in so many ways it is. But is this one of the things that's not so great about it?
You look at the last decade, and they've actually been up and down in terms of their form. And I'm sure the revenue has been great throughout that period, but suddenly they look now like they're in a position to rule and dominate for years, despite the fact that Dortmund in particular are a very good team. But the fact is that Bayern have the potential and have the ability just to pick off those the best players from Dortmund and Schalke and elsewhere. And I mean, you could say similar of Manchester United's financial position in English football, but the difference is that Bayern are in good hands. They haven't got Glazer type owners who restrict them at all and who compromise their financial strength. So
sorry, Ollie, if I jump in here, you could say it about Manchester United's position in English football, but you'd also be lying and making something up if you said that, because Manchester United do not have twice the revenue of Arsenal and Chelsea and Manchester City, do they?
Well, they have, I think they have sort of double Liverpool's. Liverpool have double Everton's, and you know, obviously these things.
But there are other big teams in England who have comparable wage bills to Manchester United.
I am aware of this, but I'm just saying that, you know, Manchester United have the ability to absolutely dominate financially, yet they don't spend all of their money, whereas Manchester City, Chelsea spend a great proportion of those, and it sort of levels out, because you've got owners who take money out versus owners who put money in, and it ends up being perhaps more of a level playing field than it might otherwise do. But Bayern, because everything is in Germany is sort of run the right way and it is more of a meritocracy, Bayern's sort of self-sustaining ability has, you know, self-sustainability, that's the word, that puts them in a very good position, because they haven't got Glazer type owners and others don't have Sheikh Mansour type owners, so it is it's perhaps in some ways a level playing field, but it creates an uneven competition.
Yeah, I think we should point out on that point, or just on the back of what Ollie's saying, is that you couldn't have a Sheikh Mansour and Abramovich by statute because of the so-called 50% plus one rule, which applies to all the Bundesliga clubs except for Bayer Leverkusen and Wolfsburg.
I think if in England, Manchester United, say, had this unbridled commercial revenue, if they had all the advantages that they have with their income over other clubs, and none of the other clubs had a sort of Sheikh Mansour or a Roman Abramovich or a Jack Walker, and if United didn't have the Glazers sort of restricting them slightly, people would think, well, I think we would be having this type of conversation, but it would be a conversation based on the fact that United have created a position of extreme strength rather than being in a false position.
I think there's a danger of conflating two issues, because there is, as you say, Dab, there is a lot that's right about the Bundesliga model, and it's really telling on Twitter or what have you. If you praise the Bundesliga, the Premier League sort of spokesmen get really antsy really quickly.
They mention the figure 1.6 all the time.
And they talk about sort of how the Premier League shares its revenues to lower clubs and what have you, and I'm sure that's all right. But you can tell, in the same way Sir Alex Ferguson only insults people who are a threat to him, the Premier League don't get concerned when you say how great Serie A might be in a few years.
It's always very nice to me, in fact.
Because, exactly. But they get, if the Premier League do not like how fashionable the Bundesliga has become. But there are two issues here. One is that there is a lot of good in the Bundesliga in terms of fan ownership, in terms of safe standing, in terms of the ticket prices, the stadium quality, all of that. The other thing, that the really good thing about the Bundesliga, is that the fact that 10 years ago they made this conscious decision to bring young players through, supported by the DFB and the league itself, which is now bearing fruit, which is why there's so many good German players, and crucially, why there's so many good German young players spread out over several clubs. But that comes with a caveat, which is the Bayern issue, which quite rightly is, I mean, Bayern, as you say, have got this huge inbuilt financial advantage. The Bundesliga model is one that could be copied elsewhere. The Bayern model is not an example for other clubs to follow, because only Bayern can do that. In the same way as it's all very well Arsenal saying, oh, well, we're self-sustainable, look at how great we are.
But the, put on the very effete that's accent my, that's when you my, talk about Arsenal.
That's my Islington.
Our Arsenal camp.
That's my Islington accent.
It's a disgrace.
You should have a word, man.
It's a disgrace.
This northern New Yorkshireman are thinking Arsenal are just a bunch of soft, like...
Well, they are. They're from the south. Anyway, Arsenal can only do what they do because they are in a place where they can charge that much money.
I take your point.
And Bayern, the Bundesliga is a model that could be copied to some extent or learnt from, certainly, but Bayern is a separate case. You have to separate that.
Julian, this is what makes me uneasy about this. And I'm not uneasy. I mean, whatever they like, and I think what they do is great. But... Now, if I were a German, like, sort of Bayern guy, I'd be like...
Do a voice.
I won't, because I'm more serious than that. But I would point out that, but Bayern have only won the title 5 times last 10 years, and look at all these other clubs. Stuttgart won it, Werder Bremen won it, Wolfsburg won it, Borussia Dortmund won it, of course. but... Here's the flip side. Now, Borussia Dortmund, the jury's out. They won it 2 years in a row, fantastic team, so on. All these other clubs won it. They couldn't build on their success. Werder Bremen won it, and then after a couple years after that, they sort of struggled to get into the Champions League. Stuttgart, they flirted with relegation. Wolfsburg also went down the tubes, and only now they're coming back. So you kind of have this, like, nobody can consistently compete. We'll see if Borussia Dortmund can do it. But I'm starting to wonder, is maybe Borussia Dortmund are like the statistical freaks and the outliers because of this incredible thing that Klopp and Zorc have put together. But that it's a model that's kind of like everything flows towards Bayern, and it's only going to increase with financial fair play.
I completely agree with you. I think it's unfair to actually other German clubs. If I was German and not a Bayern fan, I would hate them so much, because, like you said, yes, it's only 5 out of the last 10 years, but apart from Borussia, when you've got a genius manager and a sports director who's brilliant at finding players like Gundogan in the second division, for example. But apart from that, it takes that to compete with them twice in a row. Otherwise, you might win once because you'll be lucky, and then, just crumble again.
And the annoying thing is, I mean, you look at this and they go and they sign the best players from the opposition internally,
exactly.
Which doesn't happen so much, you know, in other countries, certainly not in England. I mean, you don't have Manchester United going and picking off players from Chelsea and Manchester City, which has a twofold effect, right? Because it strengthens them and it weakens the opposition in the same go.
You know, it's a good point, because when Lyon in France, I know France is far from the Bundesliga, but let me talk. When Lyon won 7 years in a row the French League, every summer they were buying the best player from Lille, even from other big clubs like, you know, PSG and Marseille, and they were killing the league because they were so strong financially and so dominant, and everybody wanted to play there because that's where you reached the semi-final of the Champions League, because you were winning the league and the cup and everything. And it just killed for 7 years, they just killed the league, and everybody hated them for it. And I think the risk with Bayern Munich is exactly the same, if it's not already there.
But there's, and I agree completely with what Julian said, and I think that is the danger with Bayern, as you say, with a model where they have got this inbuilt advantage that no one can compete with. In the same way as, I mean, the irony is that FFP has been introduced to reduce inbuilt advantages that no one can compete with, but what it effectively does is say that certain inbuilt advantages are fine, which is completely and utterly morally vapid. But anyway,
that's the Martin Samuel argument, and I think there's a lot of merit to it.
I think the issue with this kind of with who can compete is that, is it not better almost to have a model where there's one big club, and if they mess up, then there's lots of clubs at the level below who could step in? So Werder Bremen is quite a good example. Werder Bremen have had Thomas Schaaf in charge for what, 12 years? Something.
Years or even more than that.
Yeah, he's been there, it looks like a walrus, been there forever. And Werder have basically had, he had one great side at Werder that won the title, and then it kind of fell apart, and now Werder
kind of fell apart because people started buying his best players.
But Werder are basically, but they've had that success, and now they're basically a mid-table side, Werder, and I'm sure that's frustrating for them, but at least they've had that success. Is that not better than a model where you have four or five clubs who are always going to be at the top?
I mean, I think that's a fair argument.
Bayern are 20 points clear in Germany. United are, what, 15 points clear in England, probably 18?
It'll be 12 after tonight, but yeah.
Or 12, 15 or 18 points clear in England. PSG are, what, 7 clear in France?
7, yeah.
Juve are 9 clear in Italy. Barca are 13 clear in Spain. Bayern this season aren't exceptional in having a massive lead at the top of a league.
All right, now time for some quick hits. Rory was a classic relegation six-pointer at Loftus Road as Wigan notched a last-second equaliser, which Harry Redknapp calls the worst moment of his 45-year career. But who is more deserving of our scorn? Bobby Zamora for booting Jordi Gomez in the head. And by the way, Danny Mills, who I spoke to yesterday, said, well, you know what? I'm not sure that was a red. Or is it Adil Taarabt for not being a man in the wall and shrinking like a little violet in a microwave?
For those of you who don't know Julien Laurens, Julien is perhaps the most macho, sort of intimidating, shaven-headed sort of person that you could possibly wish to meet. And he's nodding in disgust at Adil Taarabt's cowardice. But you know what? That is the most brainless, irresponsible, appalling sending off I have ever seen from Zamora. And that he had the gall to protest it is offensive to my human sensibilities. So, but if QPR, that could well be the point. QPR would have won that game with 11 men. If they go down by 2 points, then it is Bobby Zamora's fault.
You hear that, Bobby? All your fault. Ollie, we sort of take it for granted that Wigan will sort themselves out and avoid relegation because they always seem to do so. But have you seen enough to suggest that things will really pan out that way?
I was slightly disappointed by them in the second half yesterday against 10 men. I think Martinez was even more disappointed by them. I know people have this sort of perception of them as being the greatest apologists, but looking at their remaining games, Man City away, West Ham away, Spurs home, West Brom away, Swansea home, Arsenal away, Villa home, it's not the easiest run. I could see them winning two, maybe. It's just a question. Yeah, they're the ones that spring to mind. And you know, will that be enough? I mean, it just depends how others improve, and you know, will Sunderland improve? Will Stoke start winning? I think Wigan might just about stay up.
Arsenal win at West Brom and actually appear to have some momentum. Julian, should they be worried about those jittery final minutes after Mertesacker's silly red and penalty? Or should they be pleased at the rediscovery of that mystery man we call Thomas Rosicki?
No worries, no, because a 10 against 11 away at West Brom, who's a very good team, I think it's normal to suffer a bit and to struggle. But I think it's very good that Thomas Rosicki, you know, is back at his best, because it's April and he's always good when spring arrives, and especially when he has to negotiate a new contract, which is not the case this year. But so it's a good asset for a strong end of the season.
Aston Villa win at Stoke 3-1. Matt Lawton scores a peach of a goal, and all of a sudden we can again call him Paul Lambert. Rory, would you rather celebrate Villa or worry about Stoke because you're such a big fan of theirs?
I saw Stoke at Goodison Park last week, and it occurred to me that Stoke have got a problem. They've got a real problem. I think teams have actually worked them out. They look like they've lost a little bit of their vim and vigour. They have. I think they've won 1 in 13 now, so momentum's against them. Got 34 points. They've got a lot of games against teams in the bottom six. If Stoke don't realise quite as much that they're in trouble as the others, then I think there's a chance Stoke go down this season. So I will worry about them, but not worry that much. Just I wouldn't miss them.
West Ham hold Liverpool to a point at Anfield. Ollie, folks are still patient with Rodgers, but do you fear that another sort of seventh place finish might push Luis Suarez towards the door, given who his agent is?
You're presumably referring to the Bayern Munich possibility, given that his agent is the new
or anybody who will go and give him a lot of money and give Liverpool a lot of money.
Yeah, well, I think I don't think seventh is particularly the issue. I don't think, you know, if they finish fifth and just missed out on Champions League, I don't think that would necessarily feel any more appealing to Suarez. I all the noises coming out are that he wants to stay, but that he wants to see their ambition. But I've got to say, if he gets offered a great move and his agent gets offered a great move, I could see him going for it. And it wouldn't really be a surprise. He's been there 2.5 years. Liverpool have been, they are improving, but they are miles off being able to compete for the league. They're not going to be in the Champions League next season. They might just scrape in for the following season. But I don't get the impression there's going to be an enormous amount of money invested at Liverpool. And I think fears about Suarez are very legitimate. And I think whereas this time last season, people might have been thinking good riddance to Suarez. I'm talking about people outside of Liverpool. I think this season he's been so fantastic that fans of Premier League football should want him to stay.
For a minute there, we were worried that Newcastle would get sucked into the relegation battle, but Papi Cisse's injury time winner against Fulham put that one to bed. Julian, was jumping into the crowd like that really warranted for Alan Pardew?
Well, we all know that Alain Depardieu fences himself as a bit of a showman, so I think it was no surprising that he celebrated like that. However, the guy who nicked his keys in his pockets while celebrating the goal with him, I thought that must have been brilliant, and he's definitely one of the best moves of the game.
Here's my one for you, Gab. Manuel Pellegrini, mm-hmm. Where does he stand in the pantheon of great European managers at the moment?
I think he's done a fantastic job in very difficult circumstances. Again, this past weekend, before the game against Real Sociedad, his father passed away. He flew out. He's going to try to be back in time for the Champions League game. I think more to the point, he's worked in incredibly difficult circumstances at Malaga. I think he's done a fantastic job in his one season at Real Madrid, despite not having Cristiano for 2 months out of the season. He actually won more points than many people's deity, Jose Mourinho. I think he deserves more respect than he's had, and I hope he gets a shot at the big time next. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. It's been real. It's been long, Skinner might say. Thank you to my guests, Julian Lawrence, the very talented Rory K. Smith, and from his parents' home on Merseyside, it's Ollie K. You can come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts. We're all on there. Or you can email, as so many of you do every single week, gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all your news, our views, our web chats, blogs, plenty of good analysis on there. And also, I already mentioned Twitter, but my script says to mention it again. So yes, tweet us. We're all on Twitter. Until next week. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.